Going to begin the meeting even though we don't have a quorum. This is the Local Government Committee of Metropolitan Affairs for Wednesday, January 10th in the basement hearing room. We're going to put off with the minutes until we have a quorum as well as the rules. So we're going to start with a presentation by Pat Dalton, legislative analyst from House Research. And she's going to report to us on local government finance. Go ahead. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Pat Dalton. I am normally seen in the tax committee. I do local government aid and sales taxes for tax committee. And today I am going to, as soon as I can get this. And I, not only that, but I actually understand a little technology, and your screen is now working. So we can actually do the presentation on a PowerPoint. I'm going to be giving a very brief overview of local government finances. Madam Chair, I understand you also wanted a little discussion about some metropolitan agency finances. And Jean Lefevre would be the person who could talk about that. You may want to start with her, or I can do mine, and she can do hers afterwards.
Why don't you go ahead and, okay. I think it was local sales tax that we wanted to talk about, and LGA.
Okay. I'm going to start with a brief, just look at where local governments get their revenues. Now, the local governments I'm going to be talking about are counties, cities, and townships. I won't be talking about school districts, who their finances is something I don't want to understand. Special taxing districts are another little entity unto themselves. It's very hard to talk about them because they all take very different forms, and actually we don't even have a real good central mechanism for reporting on their finances. They report to the state auditor, but the state auditor doesn't do a consolidated report on special taxing districts, so we don't really have very much information. But to give you a brief overview, this slide shows the percentage or the amount of money that counties, cities, and towns get from three different types of aids: intergovernmental aids, which is both federal and state aids, net property taxes. The reason we talk about net property taxes is there is a portion of property taxes that's paid through some state credits, homestead market value credit and ag credits. And those actually get shown as part of the intergovernmental aids as opposed to part of the property taxes. And finally, the other piece is local revenues. Local revenues are things like user fees. They are fines, permits. Some people make donations to local government. Those all show up in the other local revenues. This is just a table showing essentially the same information. As you can see, counties and cities raise about the same amount of money a year, about $4 billion a year. But how they raise it is a little different. Counties are very dependent on intergovernmental aid and property taxes, and they get very little of their money actually from other local revenues. A lot of their intergovernmental aid is actually federal aid, because they get a lot of the welfare money is pass through money to them, and so they get a lot of welfare money. They also get a lot of transportation money through the Highway User Trust Fund. Cities, which is kind of where I'm going to be focusing, because that's one everyone always gets excited about, used to get about one third of their money from each of the types of revenue. They used to get about one third from intergovernmental aid, one third from net property taxes, and one third from, you know, other sources of local government. But that's actually changed over time. And as you notice, towns are a very, very small part of the overall, about a little less than one fourth. About 20% of the population in the state lives in townships, but a lot of towns don't really provide all that many services. Often the township services to people who live in townships are provided by the county, and so they're a very small piece of local government. One of the things I think is kind of interesting to talk about is how have local government finances changed over time. And the time period I'm looking at is 1994 to 2004. The reason is because the only really good consolidated source of local government financial information is the state auditor reports, and those tend to be delayed. Just recently, like in the last week or two, I believe the state auditor finally put out the 2005 numbers for cities. So when I was preparing this, I did not have those numbers. But what I want to point out is that in the last 10 years, counties' aids have been going down. Federal aid in particular went down about 3%. This was partially offset by a modest increase in state aid, often in the Health and Human Service area, and also an increase in property taxes. City aids have gone down from about 33%. I used to say it used to be kind of 33% on cities. Aids have gone down from being one-third of total city revenues to only about 28% of total city revenues. And the differences in that loss of aid has been primarily made up in property taxes and in other revenues. And the big other revenues where you've seen increases have been in user fees.
Representative Fiskin.
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Dalton, when you use the words going down, is that an actual decrease, or is that a decrease in the percentage where the aids didn't actually go down? What went down was the percentage, which could very well be an increase in the other revenues.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's actually a very good point. You are correct. What I'm talking about is the share of local government revenues that comes from these different sources. In some specific areas, there have actually been a decline in some aid. Welfare is one, you know, the whole human service area from the federal government. There have been decreases in those aids. And as many of you are aware, there were some fairly substantial decreases in state aid, general purpose aid to local governments in 2003 and 2004 because of the budget crisis. But what I'm talking about here is, over the long term, I'm talking about percentage of revenue coming from the different sources.
If I can put you on hold just 1 second, we're formally going to call this meeting to order, and we now have a quorum. So, Representative Diskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Dalton, then I just for clarity's sake, on this slide it says federal aids down. All right. When you put all the federal aids together as you have here, have they in fact gone down when you look at the actual reduction in welfare and all other federal aids, or has federal aids at least been stable if not increased? Are you using down here as a percent of total or down as in actual federal aids?
Ms. Dalton. Mr. Chair, Representative Biskin, in this case I'm using down as a percent of total aids. I believe that they've been constant or modest increase in terms of nominal dollars. But then if you actually look at, has it been keeping up with inflation? You know, the answer is clearly no. So going back to cities, there's been a decrease in the percentage of where cities get their revenue, you know, what percent of city revenues come from aids, and that's been made up by an increase in the percent that comes from property taxes and other revenues, and the other revenues that have been increasing as a percent of total revenues for cities have been user fees, and the other one, which we will talk about in some detail, is the local sales taxes. And finally, there has been a decrease in the percentage of particularly state aid that is going to towns. One of the big things is we no longer give general purpose local government aid to townships. This has not actually resulted in an increase of the share of town revenues that are funded by property taxes. Property taxes as a percentage of total township revenues has stayed pretty constant. So what's happened is that they've also been upping essentially their user fees. We are now going to get to the part that I'm actually a little bit more comfortable talking about, which is some of the individual programs. We're going to start with county program aid, which is the general purpose state aid that goes to counties. There are a lot of aids that counties get, but most of them are dedicated to specific purposes. County program aid is one that is counties can use for anything they want. It's not for roads. It's not for human services. It is for whatever counties want to spend it on. This is probably the largest general purpose state aid to counties. It was created in calendar year 2004, was actually when it began. It was created as part of the 2003 session where we did some very major reforms in state aids. It was a consolidation of a number of smaller county aid programs. It was a consolidation of homestead and agricultural credit aid, attached machinery aid, county criminal justice aid. Sounds like it should have been a dedicated aid. It wasn't. It was money that they really could spend on what they wanted to. And family preservation aid, which took into account issues related to family stability in calculating the amount of aid. But again, you know, it was something that was coming through the tax committee. Beginning in calendar year 2005, county program aid is distributed through a formula. This is to just give you kind of a brief look at what has happened to these general purpose county aids over the last several years. In 2003, prior to the legislature enacting cuts due to the budget crisis, there was about $225 million in county aid, general purpose aids. They were cut significantly, actually, in 2003 and 2004. However, beginning in calendar year 2005, virtually all of the county aids appropriation was restored. So they're only down about $20 million from where they were prior to the aid cuts in 2003. Program aid consists of county aid, actually program aid consists of three parts. It consists of a $100 million distributed based on need. There's $105 million that's distributed in a way to try to equalize tax base among counties. And then there was $1.4 million in transition aid for certain counties. The transition aid, which is phased out and no one will receive it beginning in 2008, was really to deal with the fact that we went from all these little programs that all had their own little way of funding them. And when we went to a brand new program, there were some counties that were fairly significant losers. And so this transition aid was really to kind of ease that transition for them. County program aid, as I said, it consists of two parts. Need aid is based on three different county characteristics. There's about $20 million that is distributed to counties based on the percent of their population over the age of 65. So it's really based on your county's population, but it's indexed. If you have a lot of your population is over 65, you will get more money. If most of your population is under 65, you will get less money. Part one, crimes, is the next formula factor in the need formula. About $40 million of need is distributed based on part one crimes. So it's that county's share of part one crimes compared to the total part one crimes for all counties in the state. Part one crimes, for those of you who don't know, are the serious crimes. They are the murder. They are essentially the felons. The other half of county program aid is called tax-based equalization aid. And that money is distributed to counties based on their tax base and also on their county population. And it's kind of an unusual formula. Basically, it says what's the difference between $185 per capita and what you can raise with a 9.5% county tax rate? And then you get that difference per capita, but that is multiplied by a factor depending on your city size. If you are a small city, that number is multiplied by 3. If you're a large city, I believe it goes down to actually, I'm looking at Steve Hines, 1/2? One fourth. You only get 1/4 of that. this was done so it would equalize some distribution of the money based, let me rephrase this. It was done this way so there wasn't a real major shift in the amount of money going to various counties when we consolidated this program.
I just would like to comment to the committee. One of the reasons why we're having this presentation is this committee will see local option sales taxes. We'll see metro-wide sales tax. So any proposals that are not statewide in nature have to come through this committee. And so I wanted to make sure we had a general understanding of how these groups get their funding. Representative Dominguez.
Chairwoman, please let me entertain a question here. On your last video, could you talk a little bit more about Part 1 crimes? What does that entail? Is that jails? Is that...
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative, Part 1 crimes, this is crimes that are actually reported. This is not crimes that are actually solved or people are convicted of. These are reported crimes, and as I said, they are the crimes that are most serious. They are murder. I'm looking at somebody in the audience. Mr. Hines in the audience also works on county program aid, and I was hoping he might be able to help me. It's murder. It's motor vehicle theft. It's assault. It is burglary, I believe, are the Part 1 crimes.
Okay, please continue.
The major general purpose aid program for cities is LGA, the local government aid program. This is the one that everyone always thinks about when they think local government aid. It was originally a revenue sharing program for all local governments. This program was actually instituted back in 1972. It was part of the Minnesota Miracle, and it was originally distributed to all local governments, not just to cities, counties, towns, school districts, special taxing districts, all received local government aid. Over the years, those have dropped out, schools first, then special taxing districts, counties, and we said substituting counties. Towns were the last ones to actually drop out of the formula, out of getting local government aid. So now it's really only a city program. The other thing that's happened over, you know, the last 20 years is that we've really seen a policy shift in what the program is supposed to accomplish. As I said, originally it was a general revenue sharing program and every local government essentially got some money. Over the last 20 years, we've really moved to it being a needs-based program, and so aid goes to cities based on their need and their ability to pay or their ability to raise revenue locally. About half of the population in the state of Minnesota no longer lives in a city that gets local government aid. So only about half the population in the state lives in cities that get this program anymore.
Your question? Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, how long has it been since a major overhaul has been done regarding the definition of need and ability to pay? And I'm focusing more on the definition of need and how long it's been since we've looked at that, since cities do change over time.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Falsey, this was part of the controversy in the 2003 session. Not only was this aid program cut, but there was a major reform to the program, to how the money was distributed, to how we measure city need, at least how we measure city need for large cities, and also how we measure ability to pay. And I'll get into that a little bit more. But 2003 was the big year that we last had a major change, and this has been pretty controversial, and you're probably going to see people proposing more changes. But just to give you an overview of the appropriation, cities did receive a substantial cut in local government aid in 2003, just like counties did. There has been some restoration of the cut back to the city LGA appropriation, but not nearly as much as it was in counties. As I said, counties' net loss now is about $20 million. cities are still about $102 million below where they were, what they were certified to get in 2003 prior to the aid cuts. Just to make the changes in 2003 a little bit more, you know, understandable, you kind of need to know how LGA payments were made prior to 2003. Prior to 2003, LGA consisted of two parts, something called city aid base, which we more commonly refer to as grandfathered aid. You'll always hear people talk about the grandfather. That's what they're talking about. Grandfathered aid was equal to whatever a city was getting in 1993 in LGA, and then there was some extra money that went to individual cities based on specific characteristics, and the legislature passed special provisions for some cities. So that's the city aid base for the grandfathered aid. That was about $361 million. It was about 60% of the LGA appropriation under the old formula. The second part was formula aid, and this was the part of the aid that was just distributed based on need minus ability to raise revenue locally. That was about 40% in 2003. One of the other things to know about LGA prior to 2003 is it had an automatic inflation on the appropriation level. So every year the appropriation for LGA went up somewhere between 2.5% to 5% depending on what the inflation rate was for state and local government purchases. All of the additional money was distributed under the formula. So over time, the amount, the share that was given out based on the formula versus the share that was grandfathered was changing. The formula percentage was growing. So then the 2003 session happened. As I said, there were big appropriation cuts in the 2003 session. The LGA was cut $122 million in 2003 after they had certified it to local governments. There was a $150 million permanent cut from the certified 2003 amount seen in 2004, and they eliminated the growth, the automatic growth rate in the appropriation. So the appropriation stayed constant.
Representative Holden.
For the, I always think of biennial figures, and so for the biennium, was 122, was that in fiscal year 2003, and the 150 was in fiscal year 2005? Or was it fiscal year 2005, $300 million altogether?
Ms. Dalton.
The $122 million in calendar year 2003 is actually a payment in fiscal year 2004.
Okay.
And the $150 million was the cut in fiscal year 2005.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Solburn.
Ms. Dalton, for the biennium, then it was 272, is that correct?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Solburn, actually it was a little bit more because this is just measuring it off of the 2003. There would have been also about another $10 million in an appropriation increase in calendar year 2004, fiscal year 2005, if there hadn't been a law change. So it was a little bit closer to $300 million overall.
Madam Chair, one other question, if I may. How much money was in there when you eliminated the automatic inflation?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I believe it was, I want to say it was over $10 million for calendar year 2004 if the law had not changed.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as I said, not only were there changes in the appropriation, but there were changes in the formula. Probably the biggest change in the formula was that the $360 million that was grandfathered aid, that cities were guaranteed they were going to get every year, most of that was eliminated. Essentially, all of the grandfather that had been based on what cities had gotten in the past was eliminated. The $27 million that remained was the special provisions for specific types of cities. And $26 million of that was really, let me rephrase it. I believe it's $24 million of it is really related to a special provision that was enacted in 2001 as part of a big property tax reform in 2001, and that money went to large cities in outstate Minnesota, cities with a population over 10,000, and they were allowed extra spiff, as it were, of up to $2.5 million apiece. So that's where most of that $27 million grandfather was, is in those large cities in outstate Minnesota. The next big change is that we had a major change in what factors were considered for the large city formula. And you have in your packet, you actually have a one-page handout, which I'm going to refer you to, called the City LGA Program. And what I want to direct your attention to is on the back of that is an actual chart that shows the changes from old law to the new law. And it's probably the easiest thing to take a look at when you're trying to look at, you know, what has changed. But as I said, prior to 2003, there were four factors that were used in determining city need. The amount of housing built before 1940 in a city, the percent of the city's tax base that was classified as commercial industrial, the percent of the 10-year population decline, if any, in the city, and the actual city size. That was used regardless of whether you were a small city or a large city. In 2003, we kept those factors for small cities. By the way, we defined small cities as cities with a population under 2,500. That is the vast majority of cities in the state. We have 853 cities. Only about 185 of them have a population over 2,500. So well over 600 cities in the state are small cities. We actually have close to 100 cities with a population under 100 in the state. Our smallest has, I believe, now a population of 6. It was as low as 3 at one time. Anyway, we did not change the factors used to determine the need for those small cities, but we did do the Department of Revenue did a regression analysis and came up with new weights for those factors. The need measures for cities are really based on a statistical analysis that tries to look at city spending and compare it with these factors and figure out how these factors influence different levels of per capita spending in cities. This formula doesn't do a really great job of explaining the variation in city spending for small cities, but frankly, there just wasn't time. There was about 3 months between when the governor decided to reform this program and when he came up with a proposal of what this program was going to look like. So all we did was update the coefficients.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom and Ms. Galton. Can you just take a minute and explain to committee members what a regression analysis is for the sake of LGA? We have a lot of members like to take make a lot of jokes about the LGA formula. And I think sometimes members need to understand that it's actually empirically, scientifically done. It's not subjective by legislators. So if you'd allow it, just a minute or two, I think, is instructive for Ms. Dalton, who, by the way, I think she either got her master's in I don't know, or your PhD in studying local government aid and how these formulas work. She is an incredible resource to the Minnesota legislature, and if we ever lose her, I don't know what we're going to do to figure all these things out. But I think it's helpful for people to understand what these regression analyses do in helping us understand what our individual cities may or may not receive. And if the chair would permit it, I think a minute or two is helpful.
Ms. Dalton, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, I believe I was told that the next time I actually talked about regression analysis in detail in the tax committee, I was going to be required to bring in cookies. So I'm not really sure how to do them. But essentially what was done in this regression analysis, and I did actually work with the Department of Revenue in doing some of the statistical analysis. So you'll hear me occasionally say we here. This does not mean that I'm, you know, a proponent of this, but I did actually work on the analysis. It just bear with my we or my I. What regression analysis does is it takes a dependent variable, in this case, city spending, and actually in this case it was the percentage of city spending that is funded from levy plus aid. We got that number for every city. And then that's the dependent variable. And then we have a number of independent variables that are used to explain the variation or the differences in the dependent variable. And it is a statistical analysis, so we can tell you there are things called, and this is, I think, where I got in trouble with the tax committee. R-squared, adjusted R-squared, which actually says this is how much of the variation in that dependent variable is explained by these independent variables. For the large city formula, which I'll talk about in a minute, it's not too bad. We explain well over half of the variation in the spending. For the small city formula, it's pretty pathetic. It's under 20% of the variation in small city spending is actually explained by these characteristics.
Thank you.
Okay. We actually are not going to finish in the 40 minutes that we had asked you to present. So if we could just ask you to maybe pick up the pace a little bit. We'll let people ask questions as we continue, and we won't set aside 15 minutes at the end for questions, so we'll just let you use up all that time.
The other thing that was a big change and was somewhat controversial is that prior to 2003, the ability to raise revenue measure was just average tax rate times each individual city's tax base. In 2003, there was an inclusion of taconite aid. So if the city was getting taconite aid, that was added to their ability to raise revenue measure. Aid is actually determined by the difference between your need and your ability to raise revenue. So this meant that cities who received taconite aid had less unmet need and therefore less LGA. All right, we talked about this, so we'll just kind of skip over that. And we also talked about formula changes. Prior to 2003, only about, the percent of unmet need that was paid under the formula, because it was only distributing 40% of the money, was about 35-40%. In calendar year 2007, LGA pays 91% of unmet need. So it's paying 91% of the difference between need and ability to pay. The other thing that the formula does is it has caps on annual increases and decreases in aid to an individual city to reduce the volatility. There's some question about whether it has reduced the volatility enough, but we'll get there. Since 2003, there have been a couple of changes. The big one is that there was a permanent appropriation increase of $48 million beginning with aids paid in 2006. But, however, we still haven't added the inflation factor back into the appropriation. Taconite aids were excluded from the measure of ability to pay for seven cities. There was an argument made during the conference committee that some of those cities really did have unmet special needs related to having mines in those communities, and so their taconite aid was taken out of the formula. And then there's been some additional grandfathered aid granted to selected cities. The main one has been that all cities with a population under 5,000 now get $6 per capita in grandfathered aid, and that was part of a compromise in 2005 as well, and it basically was given to those cities because they do not get money under the Highway Use of Trust Fund.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Ms. Dalton, a couple of times you have mentioned the inflation factor, and I guess that just begs the question, is LGA considered an open and standing appropriation where inflation factors actually matter, or does LGA have to be passed on a biennial basis?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Distance, it has an open and standing appropriation, and that open and standing appropriation is limited in the actual statutory language.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dalton, how is it limited?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, the language in the statute actually says there's an open and standing appropriation, and then there's a second subdivision that says the amount paid to cities under this provision shall not exceed.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
One thing that's probably really important to realize is that prior to 2003, the formula that was in place was actually in place for 9 years. This is incredibly long-lived for a local government aid formula. As I said, the program started in 1972, and from 72 to 94, the funding formula for that program tended to change about every 2 years. Nothing lasts longer than 2 years. So 9 years with no changes was just enormous. And actually, it's why I ended up starting to do local sales taxes and general sales tax law, because I didn't have anything to do with it. having said that, the 2003 formula has generally had much less general consensus. There has been much less agreement on it. There has been significant disagreements on the need measures. People are not particularly happy. One of the new factors in the large city need is road accident rates, which drives people totally crazy. And if you want to know about it, I can talk to you about it later. There have clearly been discussions about the funding level and whether there should be automatic funding growth in this. And then the issue that you guys may be hearing about a lot this year has been volatility. There are some cities who have seen between 2005, 2006, and 2007 have seen their aids go up dramatically and then back down dramatically.
Excuse me, Representative Houseman.
Just to that first bullet point, could I put you on the spot and ask for an opinion or an observation about why that is true?
Madam Chair, Representative Houseman, I think one of the main reasons is, first off, there was a five-year period between 1989 and actually 1993 when the 94 program was enacted. There were a lot of people looking at this. There were a lot of studies. There was something called the LAD study, and the League of Minnesota Cities did their own study, and the governor did a separate study. So there were a lot of people who were looking at it. The actual need measures that were adopted in 1993 were actually developed by the League of Minnesota Cities. And the league came in, said, you know, this is how we think you should measure need. And I was like, you have 853 cities who are great. Okay, we can do this. So I think that's probably the biggest change, is because so many people had input over a long period in developing that formula. There was just general consensus, and nobody thought that if they messed with it, that they could get that type of consensus again.
Okay. Please continue.
As I said, people are really concerned about the volatility of the formula. 94% of the LGA appropriation is now distributed every year under the formula, which means the money can shift around every year. And this compares to 40% under the old law. Having said that, really only about 5% of the appropriation actually shifts in any given year because of the formula. But there was a problem in 2007. There was some extra volatility in 2007 when the legislature added $48 million to the LGA appropriation in 2006. It didn't make an adjustment it needed to on the caps on the maximum amount any individual city could get in that year. And there were some cities that were already at their maximum amount prior to adding the $48 million in, so they couldn't get it. So other cities got it, because the entire appropriation has to be spent. So that meant that some of the aid that should have gone to those cities went to other cities. So those other cities, their aids went up dramatically. And then the next year, as the caps went up for the following year, the money shifted back to the cities that should have gotten it. A really good example is, and we knew about this one, and we actually publicized it a lot, was Minneapolis got essentially $9 million of one-time money in 2006 because of this appropriation, because the money couldn't go to other cities. And Minneapolis knew that. They knew that that was one-time money and their LGA was going to go back down. There was some effort to, both on the part of legislative staff and on the part of the League of Minnesota Cities to let cities know that this was a possibility and they should be careful of it. But a lot of smaller cities weren't aware that this was going to affect them. So in 2007, when their aids went down, they were very, very upset and they didn't understand why. And then finally, I just want to say some factors that are now in the formula, small changes in those factors can have a really major impact on how much money a city might get. And here are three of the factors that are factors in the large city formula. And for instance, a 1% change, a 1% decline in your population decline. If your population decline went from 5% over a 10-year period to 4% over a 10-year period, which happens as you shift that 10-year period, your aid, if you're a city with a population of 20,000, your aid could shift by $381,000. And so that's where some of the volatility comes in. So, having said that, now we're going to talk about local sales taxes.
Representative Scully.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Dalton. Could I just ask just one little question, and it shouldn't take too long. When you talk about the pre-1940 construction, does that take into account any valuation? I mean, I look at this building, and I look at Summit Avenue, and there's some pretty substantial dollars there in pre-1940 construction. And I'm wondering, I mean, pre-1940s doesn't have to mean old, shabby house. So as far as the ability to increase to pay for the city's costs, is there any other consideration other than just it was built before 1940?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Salty, I think you're confusing ability to pay and the need measure. The tax capacity, the value of those homes, shows up on the ability to pay. You know, if you've got a valuable house built before 1940, it will certainly show up if you have more of an ability to pay. Essentially, what that pre-1940 housing percentage is really a proxy for is it's a proxy for the age of the city and the age of the city's infrastructure. We don't have a really good way of saying how old is the city's infrastructure. But clearly, if you have a lot of pre-1940 housing, you probably also have a lot of older infrastructure. And there are higher maintenance costs related to upkeep of that older infrastructure. And so that's really what that is a proxy for in the need side of the formula. So it doesn't matter how valuable it is. It's really a measure of the city age.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Local sales tax. Local sales taxes have generally been forbidden since 1972. This was also part of the Minnesota Miracle. Because the state started giving LGA, they said, we're going to give you lots of LGA, but you don't get to have imposed local sales taxes or local income tax. And it was actually written into the LGA law. I mean, that's where this shows up. Prior to 1980, only Duluth had a general local sales tax. And briefly, you also all have an information brief, which was just updated in like the last 2 weeks, local sales taxes in Minnesota, and there are tables in the back that show you every place that has a local sales tax, when it was authorized, etc. In the period 1991-1992, special authority was granted to six cities to enact a local sales tax. Only three were enacted. Because of the general statutory prohibition, every local sales tax, you know, any city who wants to propose one has to come before the legislature and get special legislation. 1996, there have been a number of these bills that had come forward, although not very many of them had been enacted. And in 1996, as part of a sales tax study group, there was a recommendation that there should be codification of the basic rules for local sales tax. If you're going to have one, what are the rules? And so that was actually passed in 1996, and that's where you find the statutory requirement that local governments have to hold a referendum prior to imposing a local sales tax. Contrary to some of the discussion here at the stadium debate, this was not part of the Ten Commandments. It was not part of the Constitution. this is a statutory provision, and so, of course, you can always write legislation that says notwithstanding, you know, which is how we ended up with a couple of them without referendum requirements, as I was at Representative Winchester. 1998 to 1999 was a big year, big period for local sales taxes. Special authority was granted to 14 cities. However, only three of them were enacted. Either the other cities either didn't hold the referendum or the referendums failed. And a lot of referendums failed during that period. So then you saw pretty much kind of a hiatus of local sales taxes. But then in 2003 and 2004, you started to see some interest in providing general authority for local sales taxes. And in 2005 and 2006, not only did you continue to see that demand for kind of a general authority, which to a large extent was related to the fact that we were cutting state aid at the time, but you saw a plethora, and I love that word, and I think it really describes what happened, of new local sales taxes being authorized or extended. 8 in 2005, 6 in 2006. And there was actually, in the 2005 omnibus health tax bill, on the floor, an amendment was added to provide a general authority to certain types of cities. It made it into the bill. It did not survive conference committee. So here are the taxes that existed prior to 2005. There were essentially 13 taxes. Only one county, Cook County, which has one for to pay for its hospital and nursing home. They came in and made the case that that's essentially the reason they have what they have is because of the fact that it's a tourism area, and this was a way to help make the tourists help pay for the hospital facilities. Generally, as you notice, the cities that have been allowed them are outstate regional centers and Minneapolis and St. Paul. New authorities.
Representative Fulbert.
In each one of those, have they been for a specific project? Or is there, other than Duluth, I think, was a specific project, and Stanford, was it not?
Ms. Felton.
Madam Chair, Representative Silver, Duluth is a law unto themselves. they are truly unique when it comes to local sales taxes, with the exception of Duluth and some things going on in St. Paul. These sales taxes are for specific projects, and they are for bricks and mortar projects. And the statutory provisions actually require that they be for capital projects. As I said, Duluth actually goes into their general fund, and they can use it for whatever they want. And a portion of St. Paul's actually goes for neighborhood and cultural projects, and they have a little bit of discretion of how they use the portion of their tax.
And Madam Chair, does there other St. Paul other half go into the general fund of St. Paul?
Yes, Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the majority of theirs actually goes to fund essentially the ice arena. The service center.
But Madam Chair, that was not the original intent of the St. Paul extension sales tax to fund the XL Center. That was a diversion, was it not, after the fact?
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, it was actually to deal with their convention center, their conference center, and then it was an expansion to XL, which is kind of built into that as well. There are a number of cities, as you notice, under new authorities. I list a number of things with extension behind them. The statutory requirements, The law actually says you build what you said you were going to build, and then the tax is supposed to expire, and then you're supposed to have a one-year hiatus before you come back looking for a local sales tax for another purpose. It's in the law. It's happened twice. Actually, if you notice, Wilmer and Winona both had taxes that expired. You know, they had them for specific purposes. When they got done paying for them, they expired. But there are a number of cities who have not let them expire, who have come in for special authority, notwithstanding the statutory provisions, and have just gotten the extensions without any expiration. Rochester being the most significant, it's been extended four times without it expiring. As I said, these are the ones that passed in 2005, 2006. Hennepin County is unique. Hennepin County is the first one passed in a number of years that did not require a referendum of any sort. The last one, I think, actually, was Duluth. There have been a few that have been allowed to be imposed with a reverse referendum, but I believe Duluth and Hennepin County are the only ones who didn't require a referendum of any sort. Of the new local sales taxes that were authorized, all of them passed except one. The city of Winona did not pass theirs. They are the only one that did not. Worthington was granted an extension on when they hold their authorizing referendum, so their authority is still open. As I said, there are limits and guidelines to local sales taxes. The voter approval before imposing tax that has to be used for bricks and mortar projects only and an expiration date on the tax. There are some others, like the local, the state has to collect the local sales tax. Those are the ones that are in law. There have been two others that have really been more practice of the tax committee. One is that the project be of regional significance. And that's been a discussion throughout the history of these local sales taxes. They shouldn't be things that most cities have only a local impact, and most cities are funding out of their property taxes. And then another thing, which is not a statutory requirement, but it's been essentially a reality in the tax committee, is the tax committee has not allowed a suburb to impose a tax. So Hennepin County actually is the first place that actually has suburbs in it where there is a local sales.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I misunderstood when you said Winona is the only one who defeated. What is the page 7 summary, though? It looks like a number of the imposition of the tax was defeated at the required referendum.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman,
Ms. Dalton,
of the ones that were enacted in 2005 and 2006.
Oh, that was just to that.
Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair. It was just for that year.
Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, yes. Of the ones that were authorized in the last 2 years, the only one that did not pass a referendum is the city of Winona. This will be very brief, and this is actually something that you as a committee will probably want to discuss, and that is the issues related to issuing a general authority for local sales taxes. And there are certainly reasons to favor general authority, and then there are reasons to oppose. So this just lays out probably the three big reasons why you would favor it. Revenue diversification for local governments. This becomes critical as it gets harder to, you get less state aid and it gets harder to increase property taxes, and you've already upped your user fees as high as you think you can. A main policy reason to do it is to spread the cost of regional projects to more users. When you have a project that you are really serving more than your city, there's an argument that you want people who are coming in to use your city services to be paying for some of these regional projects. And then, as I said, to offset some of the state aid loss in recent years. Reasons to oppose general authority. One of the biggest is it increases the disparity between local government's ability to raise revenue. There's a lot of policy trade-offs in when you look at financing local governments. One policy is you might want to maximize local autonomy, but there's a trade-off between maximizing local autonomy and actually providing local equity. If you're trying to ensure that all cities have roughly the same ability to provide local government services, allowing local sales taxes will actually increase the disparities. And it doesn't take a whole lot of analysis to get to that conclusion. If Bloomington was allowed to impose a local sales tax, Bloomington could probably totally dump their property tax because they have so much tax base because of the multiple minerals. If you decide to go the route of allowing local government's ability allow local sales taxes, but you continue to want to try to equalize local government's ability to raise revenue, you're going to make your state aid program, your LGA program, much more complicated. You know, because how do you include revenues from local sales taxes into that ability to pay? And if you have a general authority, do you include the fact that they have that authority, whether they've imposed the local sales tax or not, in their measure of ability to pay, or don't you? Do you wait till they've imposed it, and then it counts against them for LGA? So there's a lot of interaction between the state aid and sales tax, local sales tax question. And finally, and this is a general economic principle, if you allow local sales taxes, you are going to distort the markets on where businesses choose to locate. And using Duluth as an example, if you look at Duluth did a lot of annexation up along Highway, is it 61? 53.
And
you know, it used to be just along Lake Superior, and then it's now become kind of a triangle. And it's because the malls were locating just outside of the city limits, and then Duluth was actually annexing the malls. Rochester, the city of Rochester, which has local sales tax, is one of the most vigilant about annexing a development outside of its city limits. And it's a city with local sales taxes. It accounts for half of the annexations and catchments in the state every year. And they're making sure that they're protecting their town. But you're going to have some issues on business location if you start allowing these local sales taxes.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Dalton? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not asking for this today because Ms. Felton probably doesn't have this with her, but if we're going to have further discussion about local option sales tax, I think an analysis that she has done that shows around the country, states that have granted more local authority are states that have provided less local government aids, and that would be an important analysis to share with this committee when we talk about this some more.
If it would be possible, if you would allow or send that to me, and I will make sure the committee gets it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, I can send that memo to you.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Schumper.
Madam Chair, Ms. Felton, can you give some examples of what you meant by regional system?
Ms. Felton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumper, that's a really good question, and it's one that gets debated in the tax committee all the time. Things that have been funded a lot have been convention centers, regional libraries, some lake issues, some lake dredging, and some water cleanup. Albert Lee is an example of that. I believe Winona was originally for, you know, a lake cleanup, which had an impact outside of the actual city limits. There is actually, if you look at the information brief, not only does it list the places that have been allowed local sales taxes, but it does list what the uses have been. So you can actually take a look at what's been funded. Airports, flood mitigation projects, some joint wastewater facilities, particularly as it relates to groundwater. There have been some regional transportation projects that have been funded and some regional parks.
All right, further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Dalton. Okay, members, we're going to move on to the minutes. I hope that you've all had a chance to review the minutes. And if so, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of Monday, January 8th. Representative Houseman moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted and the minutes are approved. Next, we have the committee rules and procedures. I actually made a change to the proposed rules in item number 2. Previously, I had stated that members would be considered absent unless they had contacted the committee legislative assistant or committee administrator. But we are all adults here, and I will excuse everyone. However, I do ask that you give a courtesy to my staff and let them know when you're not going to be here. So whether or not you call, you will be excused, but please let us know. It would be helpful to know if or when we aren't going to have a quorum or have difficulty with other areas. So that is the only change that was made. Are there any other concerns before we adopt the rules? I would entertain a motion for the rules. Representative Dominguez.
Madam Chair, I approve the rules.
You move. Representative Dominguez moves approval of the rules. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, the motion is adopted and the rules are approved. Next, we're going to briefly go to Jean Lefevre, and she is going to give us a brief update on Metro Area Agency funding sources as well, to go along with this theme of how local units of government are funded. So with that, Ms. Lefevre.
Madam Chair, members, the page is handing out a one page that shows you the major metropolitan agencies and what their sources of funding are. As you'll see, starting from the bottom, the Metropolitan Mosquito Control Commission is 100% funded through property taxes. Sports Facilities Commission is 100% funded through user fees, as is the Metropolitan Airports Commission. So a little bit more variety with the Met Council. Some of their programs are 100% funded through property taxes, some of them through user fees, some through a combination. You'll see that the state's chunk is primarily in the transportation planning and transit operations, and that 63% of that budget is from the state. The only other metropolitan agency that's not on here, or metropolitan authority that's not on here, is the new ballpark authority. And that budget is in a startup phase right at the moment. They were required to, the Minnesota Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission was required to give them $300,000 to get started as of January 1. That's repayable out of the Hennepin County local option sales tax once that begins to come in. Then the county sales tax can be used to cover the operating costs of the ballpark authority, not the ballpark operating costs. And then when the bonds are paid off on the ballpark, that sales tax will end, and the team will presumably be paying a user fee at that point, which will cover the operations of the ballpark authority. So that's quick and easy. No questions. Representative Fulton.
Madam Chair, Mr. Beaver. The public safety radio debt service, I noticed you have it at 100% of property tax, but hasn't the state provided the backbone for that? And so what does this include, the $400,000?
Ms. Lefevre.
Madam Chairman, Representative Solberg, I believe that is just the tail end of the debt service. That's a number that's been declining, and I think that's just left over from before the backbone was taken over. But I can look into that further if you'd like.
Well, I think maybe...
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, it might be... I think the state built the backbone and then asked the cities and counties and so forth to, you know, provide the radios to access the backbone. And so this may be what's left of that provisions.
Madam Chairman, Representative Solberg, that could well be, and I'll check that out further and get you.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom. On that point, Representative Solberg and Ms. Beaver, there actually were some exceptions in the metro area. In fact, Bloomington and a few other cities actually built their systems before the state did the backbone, and then other cities came on board. In fact, some of the metro communities tried to stop the state from requiring them to basically pay for the system twice because they had gone out there first and they were not allowed to. So that's kind of a mishmash in the various cities that kind of got ahead of the state and had built the beginnings of their backbone before the state even created the 800 megahertz cord. So it's a little bit of both. I know from having served on that when I was on our city council years ago. But I would add one other piece on the property tax column, and that is just wondering if how that's being defined here, because a number of these Metro Council, some of the things on the list are actually also funded by fiscal disparities, which is coming out of property taxes with a select group of cities in the metropolitan area, and they're receiving funds in that way. So I don't know if members are aware that property taxes also includes a program called fiscal disparities in the state of Minnesota that I think about 17 cities contribute to and about 135 benefit from. I just to think about that being in that column of property tax.
Ms. Lefevre? And Madam Chairman, Representative, that's correct, and I think that's noted that the state aids in lieu of property taxes are included in the property tax figures. Thank you. Further questions? Okay. With that, we're going to move to the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. If you come to the table, the reason they are on the agenda is there. I have heard some discussion about potentially some people asking this authority to have levy authority. And so we ought to hear about what they do and who they are and why they might want that. So if you'd state your name for the record and then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Steve Woods. I'm one of two assistant directors at the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Also here today is Doug Thomas, the other assistant director, and to his left, John Jaschke, who will be our new executive director in about 2 weeks. He's on vacation today from his regular job until he joins us.
Right.
I've been asked to give a brief overview of some of the local governments working in what's broadly defined as water. Several reasons for doing that. Number one, they are indeed local governments. Number two, they're the organizations that are doing most of the heavy lifting when it comes to the Clean Water Legacy Act and taking care of these total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, that were center of quite a bit of attention and some funding last session. The last reason I think why they're going to be important is that in about 2 weeks from tomorrow, the Office of Legislative Auditor will be releasing a report on watershed management in the House Environmental Policy Committee. That'll be on Thursday the 25th. They'll be taking a look at our agency, Board of Water and Soil Resources, as well as other entities that are working within the realm of water and watershed management. My intent today is to cover three main things. One would be very little time on the Board of Water and Soil Resources and our interaction with local governments. Spend most of the time on highlighting which local governments are out there working in water and some of the differences between them. And lastly, finish up with a little bit of time on some of the challenges that they are facing and some of the things we think may be coming before you eventually. There is a broad spectrum of government working in water. Federal, state, as well as local. What I'm going to try and talk about today are the primary deliverers at the local level, not some of the more uncommon entities that might be out there, but these are the more common ones at the wider distribution who are doing most of the work. The Board of Water and Soil Resources itself is the result of a merger of three different boards back in 1987. The Southern Minnesota Rivers Council, the Water Resources Board, and the Soil and Water Conservation Board. And it was by unifying those three that the Board of Water and Soil Resources was created. We have an oversight role with the local governments, as well as a coordination role. We do plan approvals, some grant administration. We have a role in creating these special purpose districts and also in terminating them. We play a lot of alternative dispute resolution roles out there, and most importantly, pretty much serve as the only regular venue where local governments get a chance to sit down with state agencies to coordinate their activities in a vertical fashion. We have a 17-member board that does that. That 17-member board includes the commissioners of Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, Department of Health, Department of Agriculture, University of Minnesota Extension Service, as well as three representatives from watershed districts, three representatives from soil and water conservation districts, three citizens, and three county commissioners. And together they make some tough calls regarding policy in the state. I'm going to shift to the handout that I see has made itself its way around the room and try to highlight a little bit of these four primary local units of government that are included in the table. Soil and Water Conservation Districts are the first column that you see there, abbreviated as SWCD, came into being in 1937. We have 91 of them statewide, and we do mean statewide in that they are exist over every square inch of the state. The reason why we have just a few more than the number of counties that we have is that four counties are actually split into more than one soil and water conservation district. That would be Polk, Otter Tail, St. Louis County. Then there's also a district that straddles the line between Marshall County and Beltrami County. These are created by local referendum. And the supervisors are elected, and they serve four-year terms. They don't have much of a regulatory role at all, but they do have a statutory requirement to assist with the implementation of the Wetland Conservation Act. Their typical revenue is 40% from the county, about 30% from the state in the form of grants, and 30% is self-generated through sale of their time on projects, to tree sales, and interest earned on reserve accounts, this sort of thing. They are the primary mechanism out there for reaching to accessing federal farm bill dollars that we have in the state, as well as signing up conservation easements through things like the CREP program and RIM program in the state, and doing a lot of on-the-ground improvement works to actually keep soil from getting in the waterways and moving downstream. They do not have direct levy authority currently. They do have a number of roles, but that is not one of them. The second entity I'd like to describe are the watershed districts, abbreviated as WD, top of the second column. You do have a map on that first page which shows where the watershed districts are distributed in the state. There are 46 of them that have been formed since the time the law was passed in 1955. They are established through a local petition process and then through an order from our board. Most of the watershed districts are located not in the Arrowhead area. They are scattered elsewhere around the state. Just under a third of the state has watershed districts on it, on that area. And just over a third of the metro area has watershed districts in it, as you can see from the map insert. Those board members are appointed by county commissioners and serve three-year terms. Most watershed districts seem to have some regulatory role. The breadth of the regulatory programs varies quite a bit, but most of them do have at least some form of regulation that they're undertaking. Watershed districts do have direct levy authority. They have a number of financing tools, including levies, assessments, and also utility fee. They are the ones that undertake a lot of the large flood control projects, major lake improvement projects, a lot of the sorts of projects that cross multiple jurisdictions. It's not uncommon for a watershed district to be in three or four counties and have 20, 30 different cities and townships within it. And what they do is kind of jump into an area where their general purpose government is either unable or unwilling to address an issue, and a watershed district can jump into there and say, all right, what needs to be done here, and take a look at having the authorities to establish a project and to fund a project. Watershed management organizations are the third column, or WMO. A map of them appears on the backside of the first page of your handout. They are a metropolitan entity alone. Be the predominantly square-looking metro area. They were established relatively recently, 1982, by legislative mandate, and we currently have 37 watersheds in the metro area that are functioning under Minnesota Chapter 103B. Technically speaking, WMOs in the metro area include both 14 watershed districts that we have, but also a joint agreement type of structure for watersheds. We have 37 of them now. Back when the law was established, there were 46. So we've consolidated nine of those. Some of those have turned into watershed districts due to their failure to implement under the WMO format. Others have been congealed to work under more of a county format. Their boards are appointed by their members. I'm speaking of the joint powers entities here, not the watershed districts. Each joint powers agreement that forms these structures has their own formulas for funding and their own mechanisms for appointing members to their watershed commissions. The length of term for those commissioners varies quite a bit. Some of the joint powers agreements actually do not have a term expiration. Some of those will serve until the city decides they want to change the person. Others Some of them will overtly declare that this is a three-year term or a four-year term. Very few of the WMOs are undertaking direct regulation. Most of them are utilizing regulatory processes within their member communities. The WMO will provide review and comment and forward that information to each of the individual cities where land use alteration is occurring, and those comments are taken into account by that city or township. Typical way that they are raising revenue is by sending a bill to their members. Currently, the joint powers, WMOs, do not have direct levy authority. Most of their funding equations are based upon at least two and usually three or four different funding parameters linked somewhat to either population or area or watershed contribution amounts. They do less project work than a watershed district would tend to do, understandably. More of a coordination role among the member communities, and will undertake watershed-wide monitoring and education efforts as kind of a way for the member communities to consolidate forces and not have to reinvent the wheel. The last column in that table is addressing county water plans. This program came into being in 1985 and addresses the 80 non-metropolitan counties. It's a voluntary program. Currently, we have all 80 counties that are participating in it. One of the major reasons for that is that the state does issue a natural resources block grant as one way of getting out money from the Pollution Control Agency, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and the Department of Natural Resources to run local land control programs at the county level. These would include things such as the shoreland management grants of DNR. Pollution Control Agency has individual septic system grants that go out, and the Board of Water and Soil Resources has things such as the Wetland Conservation Act grants.
Representative Solberg.
Maybe you must have finished it this way, and I'll go but come back.
Okay. All right. Please finish this section, and then we'll come back to Representative Solberg's question.
Their typical revenue, I'll get on the regulation here. The counties do largely regulate through their normal processes that they have, whereby they are enforcing ISTS rules and feedlots and floodplain and shoreland. It's kind of the larger model of how things have devolved from being done at the federal level to the state level. We've pushed a lot of things down to our local governmental units to do the implementation of them and the regulation of them. And a lot of that comes to bear at the county level. They do get some state grants, and those are required to be matched locally. We do know from the reporting that they do that the strength of that program is that the local dollars well exceed the minimum match requirements. The counties put in quite a bit more than they need to in order to administer those programs. They do undertake planning, monitoring, education, the land use controls I've mentioned, and also play a surprisingly large role in groundwater management.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is it Mr. Woods, is that correct?
Yes.
I'm sorry. As I look at your handout and the map from the Minnesota Watershed District, particularly in the metropolitan area, and then turn it over to the water management organizations in the metropolitan area, they seem to be overlapping. And I know one is a joint powers agreement, one is, I guess, the local petition of some kind appointed by somebody. But do they have different roles, and why would we not have one organization be able to carry out those dual roles if there are different roles?
Mr. Wood.
Chair, members of the committee, it's a good question. And what we have in the metropolitan area is that the legislature said there shall be watershed management for the seven-county mm-hmm. metro, and it shall either be of a watershed district variety or of a WMO variety. We do not have any instances where a watershed district is absolutely overlapping with a WMO.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I'm not reading the... On the first map in the metropolitan area, I see numbers. Number six is the capital region of that watershed district. And I look in the other one, it says capital region. I mean, it may be a different area. But are they exactly the same, or are they Are they not overlapping at all? One's one way and one's the other?
Mr. Woodson.
Madam Chair, members, they are the same organization. Okay. One of the unfortunate outcomes of that 1982 law was that all of the metropolitan watershed entities are known as WMOs.
Okay.
Some of those WMOs happen to be WDs, which pre-existed prior to 1982. So that is an ambiguous or at least confusing premise, I agree.
Madam Chair, maybe we should have a clarification on the law so I can understand it.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Woods, some of these districts, and I have one in my district that's a water management organization, but their members are really kind of double taxed. They pay their watershed district on their property tax fee, and then they also pay, their city pays a tax for the water management organization, their portion of it. And as I understand it, if we're to look at maybe your group taxing, wouldn't that almost be like a triple taxation on some people where the overlap may occur of taxing authority?
Mr. Woods.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi. The there are cities who, for sake of discussion, say the city is split. Half of it is covered by a watershed district, half is covered by one of these joint powers, WMOs. There are some cities who do pay their bills to the joint powers organization using citywide funds. In those instances, the residents who live in the half of the city that would have a watershed district on it are technically paying into two types of organizations, even though they only live in one. We've seen a number of cities that have elected to set themselves up to eliminate that, and that's up to the city to do or up to that joint powers agreement to structure it in that way. The watershed districts themselves can only levy taxes or assessments within their jurisdictional boundary. Therefore, a resident living in the watershed district half of the city, there's no way that the citizen on the other side of the city is paying into the watershed district whatsoever. The other half of your question had to be what I think was concerning soil and water conservation districts and whether or not they might themselves go for a levy assessment, or excuse me, levy authority someday. Our agency has not put in any initiatives into the governor's budget process recommending that soil and water conservation districts get the ability to have direct levy authority. We do know that the soil and water conservation districts, those local units of government, have pushed that pretty hard the last couple sessions to look at getting that authority. We're not aware yet of what their intentions are for this session. We know that they're still exploring that, but at this point I think they are still doing just that, exploring whether or not they're going to go for that or request that.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There were surprises for me, except for one, which repeats in all three of the Minnesota statutes, for the water management, for soil and water conservation, and watershed districts, and that is reduce damages caused by floods to control or alleviate damage from floodwaters. And so I have two questions. Have we really held this level of organization accountable for flood control? I mean, is that really where that responsibility lies? And two, with the Metropolitan Water Management, we say to the end that we minimize public capital expenditures needed to correct flooding, but we don't have that expectation for the other two organizations, that minimizing public capital expenditure. What can you tell me about the flood control stuff?
Mr. Woods.
Madam Chair, Representative Hausman. The watershed entities have worked quite a bit in flood control realms. It was one of the primary drivers, I think, of why some of the original watershed districts were created in the metro area prior to 1982. And we saw after 1982 a number of those WMOs first started tackling water quantity issues. Since that time, a number of those have been addressed, and they've started progressing more towards the water quality end of things as TMDLs and other such issues have come to the fore. Soil and water conservation districts have not had a large role in flood protection in recent years as well. It you're referring into on the text for 103B, their purpose number two about minimizing public expenditures necessary to control flooding.
But we don't repeat that in the others. We say that they ought to control and alleviate damage, but it's an expectation.
Mr. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative, the 103B law came decades after the other two laws. I love the fact that that number two is in the 103B law. I think it's a wonderful way to overtly state that why we're doing what we do in natural resource management, which is to minimize the public expenditures necessary. We've seen over and over again with experience that ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure, the more that we can use natural systems to store and convey water through our cities and landscapes, it is more cost effective.
Madam Chair.
Representative Houseman.
It occurs to me that, of course, the biggies are outside the metro area, and wouldn't that be perhaps a helpful addition that we, with that language, remind them that really there's a purpose in this, and that is we want to minimize public capital expenditures to just come after the fact.
Mr. Wood.
Madam Chair, Representative, I agree. I believe those other entities are working out state with that in mind, but it is not explicitly included in their purpose language. They do have some language in some of their project establishment sections of the statute talking about, looking at cost benefits and that sort of thing. But having it right up front in the purposes, I think, is a wonderful reminder.
Representative Lannan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, Madam Chair, I want to thank you for bringing this issue to the committee. This is an area of governance in our state that needs a lot of work, folks. There is a tremendous amount of good work that's being done by all of these different organizations that are involved. But as you can tell from what we've heard, we've got sort of a Swiss cheese approach here to water management issues in the state of Minnesota. It's hit and miss. And that's why the legislative auditor was encouraged by me and many others to undertake the study that is now coming to fruition. And I would encourage that we bring the legislative auditor to this committee so that we can hear directly as a committee what they're going to recommend. But with all the concern about water quality, with the needs that we have with the Clean Water Legacy Act, we've got to have a governance mechanism that's equipped to deal with these issues, and we don't on a statewide basis. We do in particular locales have a lot of good work that's being done, but another aspect of this whole issue that isn't being properly addressed is that you've not only got all these watersheds, you've got basins where what one watershed does affects the watershed downstream, and who, on a basin-wide perspective, is taking a look at those issues, trying to make sure that everyone's interests are looked after and protected. So the bottom line, Madam Chair, what I'm saying is I think this is a priority issue for this committee and for the legislature to address.
Thank you, Representative Lannan. And we're running out of time here, so I do want to make a couple of announcements. And we will be talking about this issue further in the future. So please don't feel like I'm cutting you off. But we do not have a meeting next Monday because it's Martin Luther King Day. Next Wednesday during our time is the Governor's State of the State Address. So we will be coming in immediately following the Governor's State of the State Address just to finish up our time, but we're going to have a bill that will be heard. Then the following week, we are going to have both the legislative auditor and the state auditor both come in and tell us the difference in what they do and their roles. And so while they're not particularly coming to talk about the report, they are coming into the committee so that we understand, so everyone understands the differences in their roles and how that plays out here in terms of local units of government. So that's what we have laid out so far. I do anticipate, given we're going to have most of next week off, that we will continue to meet regularly following that. So with that, I'm going to adjourn the meeting and say thank you, members.